these people have lined up.
Connected in any way with campaigns or just a...
Well, not directly, no. Not, or not officially, but... there's a press conference today, a speech at the University of Minnesota this afternoon, speech at St. Olaf.
That was a big poster with your name on it, with Marianne Hamilton and somebody else. What about that?
Well, that's a Saturday. There's some kind of rally or something on Saturday?
Saturday at 1 o'clock, there's a teach-in at Augsburg College.
I guess the tape is rolling. Is it? Okay, okay.
I keep forgetting that we have these handy little devices. So yes, the tape is rolling, and you may proceed, gentlemen.
Thank you. We moved in here in January, and things are being installed around us and getting going from primitive to modern.
It used to be a lot more humble than it is, and I can't get used to it.
Do you want to start?
We carried a couple times on these stations that three-hour marathon session that you and Daniel Ellsberg and Iqbal Ahmad and a journalist, I can't remember his name, did with Studs Terkel. And that was so good and so thorough that I almost feel at a loss to know just what to take up with you. One of the things in that that three-part interview with Studs that impressed me was your conversation with him about your jail experience in California, mm-hmm. and policeman. I can't remember whether that was a warden within the jail or whether it was a policeman that you. Anyway, you talked about the kinds of pressures those people are under, and how beneath the apparent insensitivity there are real people there somewhere. And that you use this policeman as an example, or this prison or jail official as an example of.
I think that might have been the warden that Dan talked to the day that he came down to the jail when he heard that I had been beaten and shackled.
Yes.
The first day I went into jail, and the warden looked at Dan and said, "You know, I'm a prisoner here too." And Dan found out that he had worked in public relations prior to having been sent to duty as a warden in the prison. And in Los Angeles County, it's from what I understand, it's a general practice for deputy sheriffs to be sent to jail as a disciplinary move. That is, they get duty in jail just like in an analogous fashion to people who get sent to jail as inmates. So it's a very interesting situation.
You get that assignment as a form of punishment. It's like guard duty in the military or something, I suppose.
Right. The guards are, for the most part, well aware that they are in jail and that they spend a good deal of their day in jail. You find that some of them like it, though, and these are the ones. This is why this kind of work brings the sadist to the surface.
Yeah.
Because you absolutely have to be a sadist in order to enjoy that kind of work. And believe me, there are... I'm not saying that all guards are sadists. I would say that, I would say that probably a good 30-40% of them are. And believe me, they are sadistic. They do enjoy beating up people. They enjoy treating people rough.
We have in this state a corrections commissioner who the governor brought in a couple of years ago, who has publicly announced his intention to break down the fortress prison and to try to move the state correction system in a more community-centered, less confinement and more relations for the inmates with people in the community.
Mm-hmm.
The Peace Officers Association in this state, which consists of policemen and prison guards, are very much opposed to this man's ideas, and have asked for conferences with the governor to try to remove the man from his office. When I first read that story, I thought about that statement about the "I'm a prisoner too," because there seem to be in the society these two ways of looking at antisocial behavior or criminal behavior, if you will. One is to lock them up and to keep them out of contact with everybody else. Mm-hmm. That is the perhaps the safest way mm-hmm. to handle them. That has a lot of implications, I would think, for a lot of other things in society. And since you've spent some time in jail, would you comment on that issue of penal reform?
Well, and I not only spent some time in jail, I spent a good 6 months working in the Los Angeles County Probation Department in the research office there. And one of the primary task of the LA County Probation Department is keeping people out of jail, keeping them in the community under supervision of a probation officer. Well, this is by no means an ideal situation because you have a probation officer meddling in someone's life, and sometimes that can be just as oppressive as having to go to jail. It can be very much like a big brother kind of thing. But having been in jail, I think that it is certainly the preferable way to go. I think that we have to recognize why people end up in jail to begin with, and it is very much a function of the ills of society, the anomic social condition that casts individuals aside. It's the economic situation where an individual cannot get a job. It's a whole constellation of factors that come from the society. The individual bears only half the load. The society has to bear the other half of the guilt for this condition. And also, I think that because of politicians who play on the whole aspect of crime and crime in the streets and law and order, that kind of thing, very conveniently forgetting crime in the suites, as one says nowadays. Mm-hmm. I think that the community supervision role is by far the preferable, more humane way to do it, but that has its dangers too, because as I say, you can have people meddling in other people's lives to an extent that is intolerable. But given the situation right now, I think it is by far the better way to go.
Public attitudes toward that, though, worry me, because people are so afraid of breaking down that traditional way of locking them up. Well, why is the public so afraid of that?
Because prisons and prisoners, criminals, are scapegoats. See, a criminal is not necessarily an individual. It's a figment. A criminal is a figment of society's imagination. People often, at their weakest, need scapegoats. This is true in a whole extended matrix of situations. The scapegoats that we have known have been Catholics, for example, in periods when there's been intense anti-Catholicism. Jews have been scapegoats. Black people have been scapegoats. Certainly Hitler felt that the ills of German society could be cured if he just got rid of the Jews, you see. So the use of the scapegoat has been a very cheap way for politicians and leaders to fuel the fires of discontent.
Who are President Nixon's scapegoats in our contemporary?
President Nixon's scapegoat, his number one scapegoats is the Vietnamese. The communists, you know, Richard Nixon has spent his, it's ironic that he spent his career on the, that is, he's built his career on the scapegoat of anti-communism, portraying communists as devils, and then here he achieves his crowning political achievement of his entire career by a rapprochement with the Chinese and with the Russians. It's very very
making peace with the devil.
Yeah, right. But the Vietnamese still are devils, as portrayed by him. You see, well, criminals are very much the same kind of thing. Only it's a more traditional, a much more deeply imbued scapegoat. The very concept of criminal. If such a thing as criminal didn't exist, then we'd sort of have to reorient our lives. We'd have to take responsibility for our actions. You know. Day by day by day, rather than assuming that there are people who are bad, and we call those people criminals, and those people are over in the jail. That their identity is very well defined by those walls and by that fortress complex. And we tell ourselves that as long as we're not in there, we're good people. You see, so it's a very complex thing, very subtle thing sometimes. This whole phenomenon of scapegoats.
I wonder if you could talk a bit about your personal reaction to the experience of being jailed. Kind of a preface to that, I have a couple of very middle-class white friends who are completely non-criminal types, and one ended up in jail on an accumulation of parking tickets, and another on a drunk driving charge, and both of them had exactly the same reaction, which was that it was months before they were even able to talk about it to their close friends. Just a night to them was such a harrowing experience. And I never really got either of them to say anything about what it is about that experience that is so destructive.
Well, it's you run face-to-face with complete arbitrariness, with the lie, you're lied to, you're deceived, they keep secrets from you, they push you around, they don't listen to you, you become a non-person, you speak to a guard, and the guard does not acknowledge you whatsoever. It's a situation in which you're totally wiped out as an individual. Your identity is just totally blotted out. So I think that's probably the best way to characterize it. You're just totally wiped out, and it's a very hurtful experience, because if you step out of line, if you don't lick their boots, so to speak, they'll beat you up. You know, they in the Los Angeles County Jail, they have what they call a rubber room, where they take prisoners in and they beat them with rubber hoses, and rubber hoses don't leave any marks. So when the prisoner comes out, if he tells someone that he was beaten up, they'll say, well, he's lying. That's a figment of his imagination. And the guards will stand by one another completely all the way down the line. They'll lie for one another. So I would say that the most important thing I learned was the capacity for lying that the bureaucracy has. And prison is the ultimate bureaucracy. I felt that before I went to prison, I felt that, well, I was very cynical about prison guards and prison officials and the system that produces prisons. And I felt that they probably lied a good half the time. But after having the experience of prison, I now know that the lie was not 50%, that the lie is 100%. They lie about everything that goes on behind those walls.
What would be an example?
Well, for example, one day I was I was beaten up. I was keeping a journal in my cell, and the guards were constantly trying to steal it. I would take it to the shower with me. I'd put it in a plastic bag and take it to the shower. I always hung on to it. And on a number of occasions, the guards would try to take it from me, and we'd have a little tug of war, and they'd back down because they didn't want to start a ruckus. Well, one day, two guards apparently were not afraid of starting a ruckus, and they tried to take it away from me. I took the journal and sort of bent over and held it into my chest like this. And I told them no, that they couldn't take it because it was my private property, that it had to do with the case that I was developing for court, that I was working on my own legal research, and that they had no right to see it, that they could see it when it came out in court. They insisted on taking it from me, though, and so I held on to it. They couldn't get it away from me, so they began to hit me. They punched me in the side. They kicked me. They pushed me into a wall. I hit my head on the wall, had a big bump on my head. I didn't have any shoes on, so they tore off one of my toenails. It was a pretty harrowing experience. And right after that, shortly after that, I saw my lawyer and told him what had happened. Described it to him, a blow-by-blow account. And the news got out. It got into the newspapers, and the prison warden told Newsman. Newsman came to the prison to ask the warden about it, and they asked the warden about my having been beaten up. And the warden denied the whole thing. He said that I had not been beaten up, that was a rumor that had gotten out, but it was totally baseless, that there was no foundation for it whatsoever. So the warden lied 100%. He just lied through his teeth. And that's a typical way in which they behave. It happened on several other occasions. In all, I was beaten up 3 times when I was in jail, and each time the officials lied about it.
One of the controversial aspects of David Fogel's program here in Minnesota involves paroles. There's, in this morning's newspapers, an account of a guy who was given a 20-year sentence and was paroled 4 months afterwards, and it enraged the judge, and he's been rearrested and sent back to prison, and there's great controversy about it. It would seem to me that a prisoner in that kind of situation would be very susceptible to having the conditions on which he might be paroled grotesquely managed.
Oh, yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. I know that the adjustment committees, as they're called, in the federal prisons are grossly unfair. And these adjustment committees amount to many parole boards. They meet frequently, sometimes every month. A prisoner has to go before this so-called adjustment committee, and they determine how much good time he gets. Good time, of course, is the amount of time that's taken off the total sentence. So the so-called adjustment committee in the federal system performs this parole function month by month, or especially every time a prisoner gets into some kind of trouble with the authorities. He has to go before the adjustment committee. And it's a very intimidating atmosphere. You walk into this room, and there are anywhere from half a dozen to a dozen people sitting there, sometimes a warden or the assistant warden, the guards, the counselors, as they call them. They don't do any counseling, but that's their title. And they sit there. You're not allowed to have any notes. You can't have a lawyer. There's no one on your side. It's all of them against you. And believe me, it's a very, very difficult situation for a prisoner to cope with, you see. And usually, in order to be successful, what he has to do is he has to kowtow to them. He has to agree with everything they say, no matter whether it be true or false. And it's a situation in which the prisoner has to demean himself. He has to let go of all his dignity, you see. So the so-called correctional system does not rehabilitate at all. It takes away a man's dignity. By the time he eventually gets out of that hellhole, he has very little self-respect. So it's just the opposite of rehabilitation. And it's one more example of how Orwellian we've become. You know, the precepts in 1984 of freedom is slavery, ignorance is strength, war is peace. Well, rehabilitation is loss of self-respect in the prison system. And that's especially true in the federal system, which is supposed to be a model for state and local correctional facilities.
Adjustment committee sounds a little bit like going to your draft board when you're in trouble. I've done that. It's the same kind of rules apply.
How do you think the American people have reacted and have handled the information that came to them through the Pentagon Papers and other revelations of the inner workings of our making of policy and executing policy? I think of that every once in a while when I read the polls, which show that most of the people think that President Nixon is handling the war in a satisfactory way, or that he's more able to end the war than Senator McGovern is. It seemed to me that in terms of many of the things that Mr. Ellsberg said shortly after the publication of the Pentagon Papers, that he felt that it was necessary that the American people know the truth. Well, they know more truth than they did. What have they done with it?
Well, unfortunately, it takes a long time to read and digest such a big body of information as the Pentagon Papers. It's 10,000 pages long. There are still no more than, I would say, 20-some thousand copies of the Pentagon Papers. A lot of them are sitting up in bookstores and still haven't gotten into circulation. The Bantam edition that the New York Times printed is a small summary of the entire set of Pentagon Papers, and relative to the society at large, only 1 in 200 people have bought copies of that. But that is for a book, a very big distribution. It's a situation in which, very simply, it'll take Americans a long time to digest the Pentagon Papers. But the message actually boils down to something very simple. But unfortunately, usually one has to go through and read the entire thing before one believes that message. The message is that American leaders have lied to us for a long time, specifically on the question of Vietnam. I mentioned the Orwellian precepts a while ago, and the thing about rehabilitation doing just the opposite of what it's supposed to do. Well, the very same thing has happened in government with regard to the Vietnam situation. The American people have been told just the opposite of what was actually going on there. And what that gets down to is the issue of self-determination. Americans were told that we were in Vietnam to protect the Vietnamese right to self-determination, the highest democratic ideal. We were there to protect this democratic ideal, when actually we were there doing just the opposite. We were there undermining self-determination. So this is a pretty serious thing. If every American believed this, we would have had a coup d'etat, change in government, a revolution on the spot, you see. But it's a pretty drastic thing, and it's gonna take a long time for that to be digested. I think that's the essence of it. It's simply too much to digest in so short a period of time. But certainly, many Americans have had a chance to read it already, and they have been able to change their way of thinking. They've been able to see more clearly what goes on behind the closed doors of government. And I think it's having a very good effect, but it's a long-range kind of thing, and it'll take a long time for it to play itself out.
AT&T and the Watergate thing and the the behavior of international corporations and the internal affairs of other governments, there have just been so many things that have come along since the Pentagon Papers were first summarized for the public that would tend to raise questions in the minds of people about the credibility of their government on a lot of levels.
Mm-hmm.
And yet people seem to be, the polls indicate that people are very resistant to...
Did you see the Gallup poll last night?
No, I didn't.
Gallup poll last night suggests that about 76% of the American people know about the Watergate case now.
Yeah.
About 70% of them believe that the Watergate incident occurred. By a margin of 60% to 12%, they reject the notion that Nixon or his close associates had anything to do with it. There's a great capacity to reject.
That's right. Well, it's understandable because we now, over the past several decades, have been the object of so many lies. You know, I mean, when you switch on your television set, you see one lie after another in the advertisements. So what the norms of discourse in this country have sunk so low that I can't blame people for being cynical about everything they hear. You know, I quite often have heard the speculation that the CIA was behind the release of the Pentagon Papers. You know, I mean, this kind of cynicism is, I think, a natural result of the norms having sunk so low.
Where does that put you?
I can state categorically that, as far as I know, the CIA had nothing to do with it.
As far as I know, that's an interesting statement.
But the CIA has its hands into everything, so it's difficult to say. I do know that that when one really gets into the Pentagon Papers, it's obvious that the CIA or no government agency had anything to do with it, because it makes them all look bad. The Pentagon Papers show that the norms of dialogue within the government are very low. Standards are very, very low within the government. Government officials feel that they have a right to lie to the people. And even to the extent that news management has become a science. It has become a science which is even has a name in academic circles. The name is tacit bargaining. And entire books are written on the subject of tacit bargaining. Mathematical models are formulated in this area. So the norms, I would say, in this country regarding dialogue are so incredibly low that I'm not surprised that people are cynical about everything they hear. And I'm not surprised when people respond to the Watergate affair by saying, well, they all do that, and this just happens to be one situation in which the Republicans were caught. But the one thing that people have to realize now is that perhaps they do all do it. Perhaps the Democrats are certainly no more lily white than the Republicans are, but there's one fundamental difference, and that is that from what has come to light so far, we can tell that President Nixon has his own private secret police force, and the Democrats may be just as corrupt on an individual basis, but it's clear that the Democrats don't have an equivalent private secret police force. That, I think, is the major difference. There certainly are levels of corruption. There are bureaucrats who steal paper clips. There are bureaucrats who may even go so far as to steal typewriters. And there are bureaucrats who go so far as to misappropriate millions of dollars of funds. And that is what we see with regard to the Nixon establishment. They are using literally millions of dollars to of money that they have gotten illegally to build up this secret police.
Given the performance of the Democratic administrations from 1961 to 72, or 68 rather, while we've talked about President Nixon, the liberals in this country certainly played a very important part in establishing that public cynicism.
From the very beginning?
Yes. In a sense, the use of the traditional liberal ideal of bringing the American Revolution and its high principles to bear in world affairs, why did that go awry? What was it about that went awry? I mean, we, as you mentioned here a while ago, we used the justification of self-determination, of bringing freedom, of saving a people, an oppressed people, from an aggressed people, from totalitarian domination, all those justifications to get into Vietnam and to maintain the rationale for our staying there, those are all liberal arguments, aren't
they? Right, that's right. That's precisely the point. You find that what has really happened in this country in the past 20 or 30 years throughout this Cold War period, you have found that McCarthyism has really been rampant. The veiled anti-communism, the blatant anti-communism, are both the same. Liberals have been guilty of a bias, the bias of anti-communism, in as bad a way as the John Birchers have. Only the John Birchers have been blatant about it. The liberals have been subtle about it. You have Senator McCarthy, who would rant and wave his list of communists in the State Department, which were fictitious. On the other hand, you have liberal academics who were just as biased against communism, and but they were more polite, more subtle, more low-keyed about it. But in both cases, it was a bias, and whenever you have bias, you do get a sort of cancerous element in any kind of dialogue that you have to create. And certainly communism and Marxist thought is a major issue. It's a worldwide issue that Americans have to deal with. And if we deal with it in a knee-jerk response, if we simply fail to try to comprehend it and understand it, if we simply oppose it in a knee-jerk fashion, then certainly some ills are going to develop out of that, because we are simply trying to ignore something that is in existence and is a very potent force. The blatant anti-communism, or the as well as the subtle anti-communism, means that we've put the Vietnamese in the same boat with the Russians, with the Chinese, with the Eastern Europeans. It means that we've put the Third World, we've lumped the Third World in with Russia, with the Russian brand of communism. And that has been a big mistake, because communism in Vietnam is as different as night and day as it is in Eastern Europe, for example. And Americans, when they think of communism, they think that it is synonymous with totalitarianism. They think of the Stalinist purges. They think of the Eastern European trials. They think of a heavy-handed authoritarian government, whereas it's not true at all. For example, in Vietnam, the Hanoi government is perhaps one of the most democratic, one of the most popular anywhere in the world. And this is something I know that is very difficult probably for 80% or 90% of Americans to even comprehend, even at this late date, after we've been involved in Vietnam for so long. But this is what history is going
to
show.
It goes back to who you believe, though. I know the government has been saying something else for so long, and what you just said, in a way, Marianne Hamilton said the same thing, that she met people who were members of the North Vietnamese Legislative Assembly, whatever that is called in that country, that they were not communists. Many of them were Catholics. Many of them were trade union people and so forth, who had no ties at all to the Communist Party, and yet they were sitting as members of the National Assembly. Now, that kind of thing, most Americans probably don't believe or take seriously because their government has been telling them the opposite of that for so long. And if they've got a choice, they'll probably believe the authority rather than the challenger, you know.
Before I go on, I'd like to say that now it's, for anyone who's really interested in this, the material is available because the statements I make I base on the experience I had in Vietnam, and all of that material is available now. By the way, the interviews that we did in Vietnam with prisoners, defectors, and refugees, we did well over 2,000 interviews. There are over 60,000 pages of transcripts, and they're in the library in Washington now. People can go to the National Technical Information Service in the Department of Commerce in Springfield, Virginia, or write to them and ask about the RAND interviews in Vietnam and really get into them, read them for themselves. And you find that the so-called communists in Vietnam are the real patriots there. They're very popular, and their form of government is a very democratic form of government.
It strikes me that there's a reverse side of this coin, which also is part of the common theme that's developed in our way of life lately. And with regard to Vietnam, epitomized by the vice president being able to go around the country unchallenged, so far as I know, and make these speeches in which he says the North Vietnamese government is the most totalitarian and dictatorial in all the history of the world. And that's it, for example, censors the news media. And that is why we've got to support South Vietnam. The lack of information, the suppression of information about, for example, the nature of the South Vietnamese government, it's part of the whole Pentagon Papers thing. The notion that the right to have the full amount of information no longer applies with regard to our policy seems...
We have news reports at least once a week, though, about another chapter of the story of corruption in the South Vietnamese government, whether it's the embezzling of government funds by military officials or by people in the... just last week, the mayor of Da Nang was fired by two for stealing the rations that had been provided by the government for the refugees from Quang Tri. And that sort of thing is like almost every week there's a story like that. But the American people, as far as I can see, do not react to it with the horror or with the righteous outrage that they show toward the fact that the North Vietnamese... don't dress our prisoners well. I mean, this kind of thing, you know, it's a different kind of standard that's applied.
Well, it's because the highest moral authority in this land, the President of the United States, it makes his decision to call the patriotic Vietnamese the enemy, and that did those words, the enemy, probably have more effect than anything else. It just wipes everything else away. Hermann Göring talked about this at the Nuremberg trials when he was asked about how Hitler and the Nazis were able to manipulate people so easily. And he says it's very simple. All you have to do is label your opposition the enemy and tell people that the enemy threatens them directly. Like Americans have been told that the Vietnamese threaten America.
Distinctly Orwellian again,
right.
The news speak thing.
The Vietnamese, these gentle almost saint-like people in this very small country halfway around the world with a very small economy with no ballistic missiles, no airplanes, no big ships. Somehow they threaten us in America. We've been told that they're our enemies and that they threaten us. And when the president tells you that, it has a great deal of force, you see, because we're brought up to respect the president. And the president has a great deal of latitude, has a great deal of force behind everything he says. So he has a great deal of capacity to manipulate people, to manipulate public opinion. And it's come full circle now, where just about everything the president says is a lie. It's calculated to manipulate the American public.
Mr. Gary says that you have to leave in a few minutes, but I want to ask you, what is the long-range effect of that? I mean, you can't tell that for sure, but what do you feel might be the long-range effect of that kind of relationship between the most authoritative figure in our, the most reliable figure, supposedly, in our national life, the office of the president, and the American people? They may be voting for Nixon in landslide proportions in November, but over the long run, what will that do to our public life, do you think?
Well, it's making a police state out of our country. It's driving us directly into a situation which Orwell foresaw when he wrote the novel 1984. And it's interesting to note that in that story, the characters were never quite sure what year it was. They guessed that it was 1984. They thought it was 1984, but by then the calendars had become classified. So all I can say is 4 more years of Nixon and 8 more years of Agnew brings us into 1984. We're pretty close to that now.
Thank you, Anthony Russo.